do this.
Save it for the take, baby.
Plenty more where that came from.
Action!
Special Agent Bruce P. Mindhorn could literally see truth.
Your mouth's saying no, but your brain's saying yes.
You can't hide the truth from Mindhorn.
You are exactly where you need to be.
Hello and welcome to the Sound Barrier podcast from Silent London. The Sound Barrier podcast is released fortnightly and each episode discusses two films, a new release and a classic from the silent era that complements or matches it in some way. To find out more, visit Silent London or search for Silent London on iTunes or Stitcher. The Sound Barrier is hosted by me, Pamela Hutchinson, I'm the editor of Silent London, and Pete Barron.
Hello.
Today we have a very special guest in the studio, screenwriter and podcaster Julian Coleman.
Hello.
Today's drug-addled detective double bill begins with Mindhorn.
As the poster for British comedy film Mindhorn handily explains, Julian Barrett plays Richard Thorncroft, who played Mindhorn. A faded VHS credit sequence explains what this means. Mindhorn was an 80s British action cop show set on the Isle of Man, where ex-British secret agent Bruce Mindhorn was captured by the Russians and fitted with a bionic eye, which could literally see the truth, here represented with an eye patch with a dot on it. The creaky series ran for 3 seasons, and then Thorncroft's own hubris ended the show. He left it for a failed career in Hollywood, insulting the Isle of Man and burning all his bridges on the way. 25 years later, Thorncroft is a washed-up, self-absorbed has-been, the kind of role Barrett is used to playing. However, a serial killer, the Kestrel, played by Russell Tovey, on the Isle of Man, will only talk to Mindhorn, so, with the publicity in mind, Thorncroft returns to play Mindhorn once more. Engaging his old coked-up publicist, Jeffrey Moncrief, played by Richard McCabe, he tries to milk his tin-ear performance with the police. He also tries to milk his old relationship with co-star Patricia Deville, played here by Essie Davis, and do business with Peter Eastman, played by Steve Coogan, who played forensic scientist Windjammer in Mindhorn, who is much more successful these days. The film delights in pricking the pomposity of Thorncroft, laughing at old TV and embroiling them in a more than ridiculous meta romp on the Isle of Man, an island which has rarely played itself in the many films shot there in the last 20 years. Mindhorn is a debut film from theatre director Sean Foley, who directs with energy and a decent eye for his period jokes, and the film is more than happy to totter into the abject ridiculousness. The script, by Barrett and Simon Farnby, who also turns up as Mindhorn's old Dutch stuntman, does try to have its cake and eat it, eventually turning into the kind of hackneyed plot the TV Mindhorn would have enjoyed. But perhaps that's the point. Fictional and even metafictional detectives have always been a staple of entertainment, and Mindhorn's eye patch, moustache and tan jacket are a worthy addition to the dumber end of the spectrum.
And we're pairing Mindhorn with The Mystery of the Leaping Fish, a star vehicle for Douglas Fairbanks in 1916, but one that he later disowned, wanting to distance himself from the tawdry business of comic two-reelers. Now, despite his feelings on the matter, this loopy detective spoof is a real shot in the arm, not least because it was embraced in the 60s and 70s as a cult classic a la Reefer Madness, due to its frequent, not to say constant, allusions to hard drugs. Fairbanks plays, or does he, Coke Any Day, a Sherlock Holmes type who lives in a Heath Robinson-esque hideaway with a grotesque but obliging valet. He injects cocaine at frequent intervals, dresses outlandishly and postures vainly, but can he possibly solve any crimes? His detecting skills are put to the test when a coastal police chief asks for his help to investigating a mysterious man of means. Summoned to the seaside, Any Day sets about causing havoc on the beach, charming Bessie Love, who runs the Leaping Fish stall, and inching his way to uncovering a Japanese smuggling ring, but not before ingesting massive quantities of opium. The story was written by Todd Browning, who was convalescing after the car accident that cost the lives of his fellow actors Elmer Booth and George Siegman, and marked the end of his own front-of-the-camera career. He would direct his first movie, Jim Bludsoe, the following year. The pithy intertitles are written by comic genius Anita Loos, although they show only a little of the flair she brought to other projects at this time. The direction is credited to John Emerson, Loos's husband, who apparently reshot the film from scratch after first-choice director Christy Caban's work was rejected. It's unclear, actually, how much Emerson did in fact reshoot, as the Triangle Company financial records do not demonstrate an extravagant spend, but his name remains on the film. Critics didn't really take kindly to The Leaping Fish, although their reaction may be explained away by the fact that it was released in a double bill with the rather more forgettable Reggie Mixes In. Its enduring favourite status is well deserved though, even beyond its counterculture cachet. Not only is this an enjoyable arguably needle-sharp parody of Sherlock Holmes and detective film serials in general, Fairbanks's jittery lead performance and his preposterous props are a lasting delight. A coda to the film pokes fun at Fairbanks's own involvement in his films. He chose, wrote and edited scripts, as well as picking co-stars, effectively acting as a producer even at this early stage of his career. The Mystery of the Leaping Fish was made while Fairbanks was still at the Triangle Company, but in this year he would form his own outfit and sign a contract at Paramount. The Mystery of the Leaping Fish is a lovably eccentric, fast-paced and surreal comedy that showcases the skills of its key creative personnel, even if it's a shame not to see Fairbanks in a more physically exuberant role.
No one seems to know who I am.
You've matured like a fine wine.
A man could get drunk on that wine.
So we're back to our first episode. We've got Bessie Love.
I know, it's lovely to see her again, isn't it?
Bessie Love featured in our first podcast, but in an equally thankless role. I think we'll agree. So first off, guys, what did we all think of Mindhorn?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Very funny. And I agree that it was a very confused plot. But yeah, that was, I think, as you said, the point. It completely took the mickey out of the shows, but with a lot of affection as well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I expected a little bit more from it, so I was a little disappointed. But, I mean, I was never not entertained, and I think it is funny all the way through. I suppose I have a high standard for my sort of meta stuff like this, that, you know, watching the opening reel, I'd never believe that Mindhorn existed, kind of, because it already looked worse than the TV it was trying to be.
I mean, I don't remember the 80s, obviously.
No, of course, too young. But yeah, it is, and I think there are some very, very inspired moments in it. It goes off the rails a little bit, and I think there are clearly bits and subplots which have been edited out.
We discussed that. We thought maybe bits had been edited out of this.
Oh, well, we'll maybe come on to those then, because there's one character, a couple of characters you think get a bit short shrift, and it ends very abruptly, I think.
Yeah. Well, the ending's quite glorious in its own way. I have to say, a lot of people have described this film as hilarious, and I sort of hesitate to use that word because I wasn't falling about laughing for the whole film. But there were some great jokes, really great jokes. Basically, it had me at the plasticine telephone. And Mystery of the Leaping Fish. Julian, this was one of the first silent films you've ever seen.
Yes, I think the only other silent film I can remember watching is The Artist, which is the the modern one.
Which has a little bit of Douglas Fairbanks snipped into it, actually.
Yeah, there is a small bit. Yeah.
Yes, I knew that. I watched The Mystery of the Leaping Fish when I was quite tired, and there was a part of me that wasn't sure I'd seen what I'd just seen. I just couldn't quite get my head around the amount of clear and positive drug use that was portrayed in that film, and there was no downside to it. And I found myself trying to think of a contemporary film that portrayed drug use and didn't show kind of any sort of negative effects of it.
Yeah,
and I really struggled.
I can't think of anything. I mean, you know, you get some show the highs, but they always show some lows.
I mean, you know, we saw in Trainspotting 2 that heroin makes you into a terrible misogynist. So that's a horrible
You
thing.
See that in Trainspotting 1 as well. So.
I actually went back and looked up the laws around cocaine use in America at this time.
I mean, there were none, right?
Well, there were. It was regulated, but it wasn't entirely illegal. Mm. They'd obviously said, you know, this is something that we need to regulate, but not actually ban outright. Possibly after watching this film, they changed their mind. Because things it can do to a rubber inflatable, you just don't want to know. There are other silent films that show quite open drug use, but this one really focuses on it. So like there's a Charlie Chaplin film called Easy Street where there are junkies and things. It's quite disturbing to see. Like syringes are not generally a comedy tool.
No, and the fact that he has a belt with them available at all times, and he's literally, at one stage he injects his eyeball. He lies back and injects it straight into his eyeball.
Yeah.
That is something, again, I don't think you'd see on many contemporary movies.
We do not condone this behaviour.
No, obviously not. But it's interesting.
And it's not just coke, of course, there's opium as well, which was illegal at the time, because that's where that's... So there is actually a lovely little double standard in the film that he's taking all this cocaine all the time, but the bad guys are smuggling the opium, which he also enjoys as well, and makes him a little bit more jumpy.
But it's a bit like, you know, in Pulp Fiction, where it would be fine if she was just taking cocaine, but it's heroin, and now it causes a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to leap onto the first... leap like a fish onto the first category on our list. And I want to talk about the lead performances, obviously. So we're talking about Julian Barrett and Douglas Fairbanks, but also about acting in the films. Mm. So who'd like to start?
I'm happy to talk a little bit about Julian Barrett. So Julian Barrett's known for The Mighty Boosh originally, and then also Nathan Barley, where he played the non-titular lead character, really. And has a shtick which is basically playing a pompous, self-regarding boorish often person, often someone who feels they're a lot smarter than they are, a lot better than they are. And that's exactly what he's playing here. The credit montage, the VHS credit montage, where we see the full credits. And I guess I don't really understand why that credit montage existed. You know, who would have a VHS showing the high points of Mindhorn and then where things went wrong as well for him? But I suppose it might be some kind of sizzle reel that he sends out to people in the 90s. But yeah, it's clear that, you know, his height of his powers in this dumb cop show, where he's clearly playing very broadly and quite badly, but he's apparently quite sexy. Mm. And does he pull that off, Pam, the sexiness from the early stuff?
Julian Barrett's a very attractive man.
Okay, that's all I need to know, because obviously by the time we get to the film, he's got a toupee, which is flapping on and off. He's out of shape, he's wearing a girdle.
Yeah, there's a lot of vanity piercing in this film. Yeah. So when we first see Julian Barrett, he's doing his voice exercises, isn't he?
That's right. Yeah. And he's fallen as far as living in a flat in Walthamstow, I believe.
It seems to be a terrible way to end up.
That's an example of the kind of joke that I don't think hit the mark.
No.
In as much as I think if you sat down and just spent a little bit more time, you'd think of somewhere funnier than Walthamstow. I'm not saying Walthamstow isn't funny, but anyone who knows Walthamstow, and you two both live there, will know that.
Don't tell everyone.
I know. Sorry. We'll know that it's not like down and out central. You know, I would have placed him over somewhere in West London.
Ooh, okay. I would have thought maybe, you know, he'd be out in Essex. You know, he'd be out of London.
Chingford would be funnier than Walthamstow.
Chingford is a very funny place.
We'll see after the election.
So I thought it was quite interesting talking about that's sort of what happens to the Douglas Fairbanks character in this Leaping Fish as well. All the way through, you're seeing this quite ludicrous character, which Douglas Fairbanks, you know, inhabits very well. And then at the end, you have this little joke on Doug. Mm. How did you react to that?
Yeah, again, I was confused, essentially, which is my reaction to a lot of things. It kind of feels like the film's ended, and then you get this extra bit where he's playing himself again, and he's just pitching the whole thing. Spoiler alert.
I think this film's 101 years old. Yeah. I'm allowing spoilers for the mystery of the Leaping Fish.
That's good. It kind of took the gloss off it a little bit for me, because it kind of feels like they're taking something back from the main film.
There's kind of an embarrassment about it, isn't it? Like, we've just made this really silly film. Oh, look, we won't make it again. This is a dumb idea, Douglas. And it's like, actually, it wasn't that silly. Well, it was. It's completely silly, but it's very entertaining. I'm not a big fan of it, though. I do like the little face he pulls at the end.
The face he pulls at the end is very kind of Charlie Chaplin face. Yeah. It's trying to say, oh, we're distancing ourselves from this film, but actually it makes Douglas Fairbanks look more like a star. And you can remember him looking dashing with his boater on, rather than dressed up like Sherlock Holmes with his the check trousers
And movable facial hair.
Yeah, he's twirling a moustache, which you don't often see in silent movies.
No, it's constant. I just did that. I just did it.
And his moustache goes off, goes upside down at one point, becomes a goatee at one point. Yeah. It flaps around a fair bit, so...
I mean, the costume, like the props, we'll probably talk about later, is fantastic. Yeah. I love his top hat, particularly. Mm. One of the things I thought was quite interesting, that when you compare the two of them, so the Leaping Fish, it's really all the Douglas Fairbanks show. No one else gets a look in. Mm. Whereas you think that because Julian Barrett is overacting, playing someone who's overacting, Mindhorn would do the same thing. But actually, there are some fantastic other performances. And I'd have to say that chief among them, for me, is Simon Callow eating a salad.
Yeah, of the two cameos, Simon Callow does a lot better than Kenneth Branagh.
Oh, poor Kenneth Branagh has the straight man role.
Yeah, he does have the straight man. But again, those ones were kind of, here, this is in the real world type stuff. And I can't say I cared for them that much, though Callow is much funnier. It's all part of the setup, which isn't laborious because it's always entertaining, but feels that it's, you know, here's who we can get, you know. And so I wonder how far down the list Callow was.
I think it's slightly unfair to suggest that Simon Callow and Kenneth Branagh are not top of anyone's list.
I think Kenneth Branagh was top of the list, because I know that he's worked with Sean Foley before, so I think he knew he could get him straight off the bat. But I think Simon Callow may have been lower down the list, but gone, oh, actually, he would be really good. Yeah. And yeah, he's definitely enjoying it.
And definitely, I mean, if you ever need a salad-eating cameo in a film.
He's in, yeah. I think the thing about the other performances, though, the stuntman played by the co-writer...
Simon Farnby,
is just amazing in it. I absolutely loved that character the whole way through. The scene where he tells his little joke, fall painfully flat, but do the job of utterly humiliating Julian Barrett's character. Just fantastic.
The writers have written themselves the best roles. Yes. I mean, I think there are some woefully underwritten roles in it. So Andrea Riseborough gets nothing to play with, and... her character makes no sense. Going from policewoman to hit woman in no time at all.
I suspect she is enjoying it there with her sassy undercut and her bicycle leather.
I think she may have had some stuff cut. I think there's a transition sequence that maybe cut from there. Oh yeah, she seems to enjoy wearing the bicycle leathers and all that kind of stuff. But
that just does remind me of one of the funniest jokes in the film, and also something that you'll sympathise with particularly. When we sat down to watch Mindhorn, Julie and I went to see it together, I was thinking whether it would be best paired with The Leaping Fish or with another film, Sherlock Jr. And I was waiting for a motorbike chase. The first moment I saw that motorbike, and the funniest joke in the whole film, I think, is when they throw away the keys to the motorbike.
We're on the Isle of Man, the island of TT racing. Yes. There is a motorbike, but we can't afford it.
Yes, the throwing away of the keys rather than stealing the motorbike is a lovely moment.
So what do we think of Russell Tovey?
I think he's okay. Mm. I think the character is not brilliantly written. And I think, you know, they're character who's stuck as a child or whatever. It's a bit hackneyed, but I mean, when he gets going, mm-hmm. you know, and as the kestrel,
as the kestrel soars,
yes, he's quite good. And he does get my favorite joke in the whole thing, actually, is when he rescues Mindhorn and basically glues him into his costume. That actually, I think, was the visual humor, which we'll come to.
Yeah.
But I think was terrific.
I sometimes wonder whether he was a little bit old. He'd lost his sort of youthful innocence to me, Russell Tovey.
Yes, yeah. And I think the whole 25 years thing, I mean, because we're looking at the late 80s, actually slightly more than 25 years, stretches credulity up to a point. And this mm-hmm. This project has been knocking around for a fair number of years. I mean, Barrett doesn't really look 30 years older than he was then, even with the floppy hair.
Is there anything else anyone wants to say about the acting?
I mean, from a lead acting point, there isn't anyone else really to talk about in The Mystery of the Fish. I think the interesting about the acting in there as well, because it's Fairbanks, you do expect, as you said in your intro, a lot of capering. And whilst he's jittery, he doesn't jump over many things.
Yes, you really, with Fairbanks, you always want him to do some parkour, even at this stage in his career. At this stage in his career, he was making films that had all the athleticism, but also he was making films that sometimes were a little bit serious, had pretended to a little bit of drama. So this film is about absolutely nothing, and all he does is hop on the spot.
Yeah,
he doesn't get out of a chair for 5 minutes. It's like a Douglas Fairbanks movie where he doesn't get out of a chair.
When it comes to acting, I've seen this film quite a few times now, but that first sequence when he's in his, I suppose you'd call it his Sherlock Holmes style study, doesn't it just look a bit like a dressing room to you?
Yeah, very much so.
Definitely. I feel like there's a little clue to the ending there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, I think we're about ready to score these films. So who wins on the acting?
I'm going to give it to Mindhorn.
Okay.
Because I think that there's more to that central character, as much as I like Fairbanks.
I would agree. I'm going to give it to Mindhorn as well, partially because I'm a big Julian Barrett fan.
Well, he's got a great name.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it to Mindhorn too. I mean, we didn't really talk about it, but S.C. Davis I thought was fantastic as well. So, yeah, I'm afraid that is across the board for Mindhorn.
Suspected serial killer Paul Melly has escaped from hospital and is on the loose.
I would only speak to Detective Mindhorn. Oh, more people are going to die.
He thinks Mindhorn is a real detective.
Get me Mindhorn.
Why are detectives funny? I mean, crime and crime solving should not be amusing. Yet, we have two funny detectives here and they're not alone. What is so funny about being a detective?
I think surely part of it is we have so many serious detective films and TV shows that they're ripe for parody.
Mm.
And it's a format everyone recognises, so therefore it's quite easy to subvert it and make it amusing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also because we see these procedurals so often that every aspect of it we know about. So we know about forensics, we know about how TV shows are made. We know about, you know, with Mindhorn, we know not just how real detectives are supposed to be, but we also know how fake detectives are supposed to be.
Mm.
So they're really easy to sort of tweak in places. And it's not just doesn't have to be a broad parody. It can be a parody of a certain part of that. And even going back to, 1916, when there would be a lot less of the way of detective fiction and certainly less
of masses of it.
No, by the accretion of stuff, there will be clearly 100 years less.
They have written
Do you
more.
See my point? but certainly on screen as well, there would be slightly less. And so
your historical knowledge is not welcome here.
No, of course it was bigger than some. But also, I'm picking this and sort of saying, and this is, you know, if you don't know anything about Sherlock Holmes, you're not going to get this as a parody, because the name is not a parody.
No.
But you need to know a couple of key things about Sherlock Holmes, which is he takes drugs.
And he wears strange clothes, according to the stage adaptations.
Exactly,
things like that.
Yeah. And beyond that, because it hasn't got a Watson, really. I mean, it's got his manservant, but he's not really a Watson. The case is clearly an American West Coast beach plot, so that's not going to be very Sherlock Holmesy. But it doesn't matter, because he's just got the two core things in the middle, which is eccentric drug-taking, wears weird clothes.
I think it's quite interesting that in both films you've got people who believe in coke any day and in Mindhorn. So we've got the Russell Tovey Kestrel character who believes in Mindhorn, and that we see from the beginning, we never believe in Mindhorn.
No,
but he believes in Mindhorn, he might just be right. And, you know, I think Bessie Love's character, she sort of has a little bit of faith in coke any day, but it's mostly Fairbanks himself who believes.
It's almost as if he's got some kind of crutch that helps him have a lot of confidence.
Yeah. Also, he's called on to the case by the police, isn't he?
In both cases.
Enlist him. Yeah. Mindhorn more reluctantly, though.
Yes.
I don't think they really want him involved. They don't seem to have a lot of choice. But in the Mystery of the Leaping Fish, they set out to find him.
Yeah, yeah. That this is who they want. But then it is a rather bizarre crime. And actually, the crime in the Leaping Fish isn't really a crime initially. It's quite similar to the end result of Mindhorn, in that it's a mysterious, rich white man and we just don't like him.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things is in both cases as well, I mean, certainly in Mindhorn's case, it commits and perhaps overcommits to its detectiveness, you know, because it isn't a film about a real detective. It's a film about a pompous actor. And when it decides to go, okay, there is more of a mystery here and there is more stuff going on, I mean, it doesn't remain a mystery for very long, and we're never engaged in the actual mystery, but the film has to go through the motions of solving the crime, and which drags it down a little bit.
Yeah, it does. It's almost like you don't actually want people to really get shot in Mindhorn.
Yeah.
No. No, you don't want actually guns and crime and double-crossing and all this kind of thing.
On the Isle of Man.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Such a nice place.
Unlikely. Mystery in the Leaping Fish doesn't quite have that, though. You know, there is still a little bit of detecting going on. I mean, he bangs on a couple of doors at one point, and you know, and he has a fight in the dark,
which is quite fun. Yes. I have to admit. Last time I saw this projected, it was at Slapstick Festival, and I just remember like laughing like a drain like that. I wish I could remember who was playing on that screen.
I think it was John Sweeney.
That would make sense. So, who's your favourite detective?
I'm going to go with Coke any day, because I would want to see more of Coke any day. I think he's a franchise character ripe for reinvention.
I think it's a very good point. What do you reckon, Julian?
I think it's a tricky one, but yeah, I'd go with Coke.
Coke is it.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous name, obviously, but his just jumpy aboutness is fun all the way through.
I think I'm going to go for Leaping Fish Kenny. I'm going to go for Coke any day. Oh, good Lord. What I like about Mindhorn is really Richard Thorncroft, I think.
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, Coke any day is a detective. No. Mindhorn isn't.
Hello, old friend.
Stay in character at all times.
When I go in, I go deep.
When he calls, keep him on the line.
Mindhorn makes people wait. And when they wait, they become angry. And when they're angry, they make mistakes.
Yo, what's going down?
Hello?
Oh, Jesus. He's hung up.
The other thing I thought was strange, because we all know they're bad, okay? Why are drugs funny?
They're not.
Okay. Julian, are drugs funny?
They are. Very funny.
Okay, so now we can have a fight. So in both these films, drugs are absolutely hilarious.
To qualify what I said, basically, people on drugs aren't funny.
That is a very good point.
In real life.
And whilst the cinema seems to think that they are funny often, there's a good, like, only 25% of drug films which are actually funny, I think.
And Mindhorn doesn't rely on drugs in any similar way to the Mystery of the Leaping Fish.
Yeah, I mean, I think its drug sequence is one of its weaker sequences in Mindhorn. There is a part where Thorncroft gets out of his box on a number of drugs, including cocaine. some of the consequences are quite funny.
Absolutely.
And very lowest economic, but funny.
I think it's interesting that Mindhorn's portrayal of drug taking doesn't really move on from Leaping Fish whatsoever. You know, you'll take loads of cocaine, you'll get really, really jumpy, you'll make a bit of a fool of yourself, and odd things will happen.
Yeah.
It might be entertaining. I mean, one of my favourite jokes in Leaping Fish is when he injects the cocaine into the inflatable and then it starts reacting as if it is a human being that has taken cocaine, and it starts fizzing around all over the place. I like the fact that you can talk about drugs and use them purely as a comic device, having nothing to do with any kind of science or worries about addiction. They're just a prop, really.
So you don't think Coke Any Day is addicted?
I think Coke Any Day is addicted, but I don't think it's shown as a problem.
No. Yeah, and so that in some ways I think that's why the Mindhorn depiction is a little retrograde from even Leaping Fish, because the Leaping Fish shows that, as we sadly know, you can be relatively high functioning and addicted to something.
It's not a problem for Coke Any Day because he has a regular supply.
Yeah.
I suspect if you cut his supply, then you might see a very, very different Coke Any Day.
So he might not want to be stopping the smuggling rings.
No.
He might be cutting off his own foot or his own supply.
I mean, it is interesting because the most common drug used in comedy is weed, marijuana.
Have we done a study of this? I suppose that's true.
Yeah, I think it's true. And of course, that's one they don't go to in either of these films. And what that's, you know, that's supposed to make everything funny, whereas Coke is supposed to make you, you know, or does make you overly confident, brash, and, you know, yeah, fizzy in your head and all that kind of stuff, from
we
what I've heard.
We should have had some before this podcast.
From what I've heard. So, yeah, so, I mean, is it because there's a shortage of comic cocaine films that drug films aren't funny?
When I think of cocaine films, I think of, like, American the Scarface Psycho. Remake or American Psycho.
Yeah.
Real comedies.
This is a nice stab at making cocaine amusing. One of the things I think, apart from, I know I did say that Mindhorn doesn't take the drug use trope on any further than Leaping Fish. There's one thing that I found really quite moving and hilarious. After the drug binge, Mindhorn decorates a car with rather childish scribbles, and then he ends up having a conversation about the parentage of a girl he thinks might be his daughter and his lost relationship, and the woman winds up the window and there's the penis
he's drawn a penis on a car.
It's a visual gag that ends a very moving conversation. I thought it was an eloquent way of illustrating that sometimes the consequences of one night's drug binge may get in the way of you and your personal relationships, and it's basically two seasons of Mad Men in one window wind.
And Essie Davis acts the hell out of that sequence. She's great in that bit.
She is fantastic. She's a very dignified actress, despite everything around her being undignified. So, which film is funniest about drugs?
Leaping Fish is funniest about drugs by quite some way. It is one of the funniest films about drugs ever made.
Absolutely. Leaping Fish, again, for the same reasons. That's, as I said at the start, I can't think of another film that has made drug use look quite so entertaining.
Yeah, not that we condone any of this, kids.
No, I'm not saying it makes me want to intravenously inject drugs every 5 minutes.
No. Well, no, because you'd have a little clock that said eat, sleep, dope, drink.
Yes.
And so you might occasionally do one of those three other things.
And that drink, unfortunately, the last time I saw it, the print wasn't good enough for me to see what was in the drink, but it's mainly...
It's laudanum.
Laudanum, isn't it? Yeah, that's right, yeah. So
the drink is actually also a downer, though, at least. Yeah. So, you know, he's going up and down. Well, it really is like Trainspotting.
Ahoy there!
TV cop helps real cops solve crime.
Let's save some lives.
Richard Horncroft.
Twang!
Look who it is. It's Mindhorn. Look at him now. What is this?
Well, that's called living the high life.
Yeah, too many biscuits.
So here's something where I think Mindhorn might have more to offer than Leaping Fish, though perhaps a little too much. Plot. Right, so there's a lot going on in Mindhorn.
Yeah, too much going on in Mindhorn, really. And I think it's the problem Mindhorn has is that it's committed to its sit, which is, you know, TV character comes back and solves crime, or is involved in solving crime. And in doing that, it has to build itself up a plot within a plot, plus all of its side plots.
And the twist.
Oh, yeah, because it has a twist, though... Twists. I mean, it is. I mean, again, and there is that aspect, as I mentioned earlier, where it does mirror those kind of episodes where the non-attached characters must be the bad guys because they haven't got anything else to do. Yes. There aren't many extraneous characters. I mean, it could have been Steve Coogan's Windjammer.
Steve Coogan, we haven't really talked about. He's brilliant. A very, very painful moment when they're reunited.
Yes.
Spectacular. I loved that bit. That was possibly my favourite scene.
Did Do you think he overwhelms the film a little bit by being Steve Coogan? And what with the Barrett character being so similar to
I thought it might, but I didn't feel that in the end, actually.
Yeah, I think he underplays it just about right, and he's not in it much, so...
No.
And things we all know about Steve Coogan.
Yeah.
I mean, from the trip, we all know about Steve Coogan, so he doesn't need to push the point home.
Yeah, we know him from the 90s and Ferraris and stuff, so, yeah.
Well, he would have made a good Coke any day.
Yes, yeah, he would, yeah. Well, maybe we should send it to him. That's,
straight off.
It's got to be in public domain,
it
though,
is
right?
In the public domain,
there
very
you go.
Much so, yeah.
Quigs in.
So one of the things that Mystery of the Leaping Fish, I have seen it a few times, and the plot, I mean, it almost feels like the plot just goes for a wander and gets lost. You're busy with Douglas Fairbanks, you don't need me for a while. It's very loose, isn't it?
It is. Leaping Fish is half an hour long, just under half an hour long.
Yeah, it's a two-reeler.
So
yeah.
It hasn't got much room for a lot of complicated plot. So it goes from A to B pretty much as the wind and whim and fishes take it. So
I sort of think the coda is maybe a way to sort of make up for the fact that despite that, you know, it's mostly a comedy, but, you know, if you wanted a bit of story, here's our little twist. Whereas we have a little twist at the end of Mindhorn. For me, the interesting thing about the Mindhorn character and the scenario is the actor and the role and what it means to him and what it means to people around him, like the Kestrel and his lost girlfriend. So you don't really care about this guy that's murdering people on the Isle of Man.
No.
The end sequence, or rather, not quite the end sequence, but the beach sequence at the end of Mindhorn, is actually quite moving at some parts.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It does it well. And the sequence prior to that with the in the fate where there's the parade again. I love that scene.
That was very funny.
It's just a great bit of comedy.
And basically, sort of reenacting its own story again and again. This film just plays its own plot out so many times.
Absolutely. It did need some sort of plot within a plot, and it does go quite far. Mm. But yeah, they needed someone to rail against, so I had to put it in somehow.
I suppose there are aspects of it where the plot is, we get the exposition in advance, we've got Chekhov's fake blood. It wasn't a moment where I worried about what was happening at the end.
Well, I was worried he was going to suffocate in that costume.
Yes, yeah, that possibly. And it does have a moment of, you know, semi-drug-addled nonsense at the end as well, which is, again, shot very, very well. And there's some nice visual flourishes there. A little bit more work on that could have made the plot funnier. Mm. And, you know, the humour can come from plot, and it doesn't really here. It's everything else around it. And sometimes it distracts from that.
I mean, I found myself, you know, we watch all these detective series. I mean, I don't watch that many, but, you know.
I've seen enough in your time.
I've seen enough in my time. There's a sequence where Thornycroft as Mindhorn, or Thornycroft as Thornycroft, but pretending to be Mindhorn, is in the police station and he's got to intercept a call from Kestrel. And there's so much detail in this scene, and they show you exactly, like, I felt myself getting drawn into it as if it was a detective program. I'm like, no, but he was standing by the window, and that means the Kestrel will have seen him. It's like, it doesn't matter, Pam. It doesn't matter at all. You know, they're going to chase in the wrong direction. He's going to find him at the quarry, and yeah, that's all that has to happen. Because we're used to all these trappings and to seeing, you know, our much-loved British actors, like Andrea Riseborough in a policewoman's uniform, just think,
that's a tick, I believe.
I mean, she'll always be a Maggie Thatcher to me.
Yes, and that's why she was naturally the bad guy. You could tell from the minute she walked on the screen.
Well, I'm going to go first with my scoring because I feel like I leave it to you guys, and I'm going to say that I actually really enjoyed the way that Mindhorn's plot twisted and turned around, and that I always felt I was situated in the overarching narrative of this poor, sad actor who wants to get his girlfriend back.
I am going to give it to The Leaping Fish. I felt that Mindhorn overdid its plot, and so therefore I have to mark it down, even though Leaping Fish hasn't really got a plot.
So, Julian, would you like too much or not enough?
I'm going to go for too much. Yes. I think Mindhorn shades it by virtue of having a plot.
It's truth time. You're living in a dream world.
Can you see the truth?
Richard.
How do I look?
Like you need some help.
Too late. I walk alone.
When we saw the trailer for Mindhorn, I thought, Mystery of the Leaping Fish. And mostly, I think in the trailer there is some reference to drugs, but mostly it was to do with this kind of loopy-looking detective, plastic detective. So we're going to talk about the visual humour and the sort of contraptions and things, because something I really enjoy in film is a selection of odd props. And in the Kestrel's lair, we have many, many odd props from he makes things like plasticine. He saved all the merchandise from watching the Mindhorn shows. And then when he wants to sort of restore Thornycroft to his Mindhorn days, he makes him the most ludicrous costume that has padded in muscles and little bits of chest hair and like leg jeggings, handmade jeggings.
It is like an action man brought to life. I
mean, it literally is. And that's, and so there's a bit where you think there's got to be an underpants joke here that he's stuck him into his underpants, or he's removed his genitals, though that would take it too far.
I think it's quite clear he hasn't.
But the other prop from Mindhorn that I found slightly frustrating was the eye patch, which is made a big thing of in the trailer, in the VHS thing at the start, that he can see the truth. And obviously, I'm aware that isn't a real thing.
Oh, that the actor, when did you realise that?
Didn't get taken, kidnapped by the Russians and experimented on. But literally nothing is made of it.
Yeah.
And even the Kestrel, Russell Tovey doesn't believe that or doesn't mention that he should use that at any point.
Although he does have scars around his eye. I think Russell Tovey has scars around his eye that sort of suggests that maybe at one point he tried to
put a bio-kai in.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that would be quite a grotesque and very, very painful thing to put in the middle of this film.
With all of the merchandise that the film suggests that Mindhorn had against him, I don't believe for a BBC show of its time, but nevertheless, for all of the merchandise it had, you would have thought there would have been a truth-telling eye patch, which what it did basically was just flash occasionally, and that would be used.
Yeah.
You know, when because he does super glue the eye patch to his face.
Yeah.
When he sees him later.
And his hair down as well.
Oh, the hair. Yeah. Well, there's more than toupee, isn't it? I think he's put on a whole new buzz of like action man style hair on him as well. The whole shock of that sequence is part of the gag, but it is hilarious, that bit.
Yeah. And I think it shows that, you know, just sort of set design can be funny. Which is where we start with Coke Any Day, and you think that's going to be the kind of humour all the way through. Mm. It starts very strongly, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, his dressing room stroke lair is full of visual gags. He's got a nice big disguise kit that says disguises on it.
Yeah.
He's got a skeleton that acts as a doorman type thing.
Yeah, he passes the business card through. He's got this ridiculous safe entrance door and even a intercom.
Yeah, periscope. Periscope, which is like a CCTV camera.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Well done. But once he gets out of the building, I think the money ran out.
Yeah. And one of the things I do like when they say, you know, this chap is literally rolling in cash, and you cut to him and he's lying in bed and he's surrounded by money. He's covered. He is drowned in money. I've never seen in any sequence, maybe apart from, what was that cartoon we used to watch when we were kids with the little duck millionaires?
DuckTales, yes.
DuckTales. And
Scrooge McDuck.
And they had a
pool made of coins that if you dived into would kill you.
This guy is so surrounded by money that he has to get his own valet to press him out a fresh bundle so that he can go out and spend some of it. After that, he really takes a dive.
Yeah. I mean, with the exception maybe of that, the coked up leaping fish.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few, you know, reverse tricks and
the telescope
fight.
Top hat.
Yeah, telescope top hat. But apart from that,
The car.
Yeah, I was trying to work out why he would have such a car, and you shouldn't think like that.
No. And why? And the guy standing on the back blowing a horn.
Yeah.
Which is utterly.
Get out of the way. They play checkers on his on the flap of the car.
He's supposed to be investigating this case. They just stop for a game of draughts.
Well, it's like Mindhorn asking for an Americano, isn't it?
Yes.
I thought the car actually made me think of Mindhorn when watching it again, just because it was a bit like that Wacky Races Fate bit at the end of Mindhorn.
I mean, visually, it's as inventive as many of the films of its age. You know, there are, I'd say, reverse tricks. There are some good gags, but it stops being that Heath Robinson-esque machine. Rube Goldberg, as I would say.
That's what they would say. I think one of the things I really loved about Mindhorn is that he kept that up right till the end, the kind of visual humour and the absurd quality. I really felt this was Julian Barrett's strength. Julian Barrett's strength seemed to me, you know, the actor character, which he does, you know, the sort of slightly pompous character who says, Barbara Baboon. And this bizarre visual world, which plasticine videotapes and everything. I just
tremendous.
I absolutely love it. I really like a Michel Gondry film, if you didn't know that about me. And this was a bit like if Michel Gondry had directed Bergerac, and then I think I would be pretty happy with that.
That would be quite boring, though. Because Bergerac was always boring.
Do you know, actually, I never saw that one.
No?
Because I don't really remember the 80s
You're
that well.
You're too young. There's this thing about, because obviously Bergerac is clearly at the heart of this show, though, because Bergerac didn't have any bionic powers. And John Nettles, I mean, I don't know whether John Nettles was an egomaniac at the time.
Who made a brat of himself on Wogan.
Yeah, my sense is he wasn't, because it ran quite a long time for a show that was set on Jersey. and nothing really happened, apart from Lisa Goddard turned up every now and then and stole a diamond or two.
Were there not lots of crimes in Bergerac?
There were, but they were like really rubbish crimes once a week. Oh. And under their nose, there were terrible things happening.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, one of the biggest visual gags in Mindhorn is the Isle of Man itself,
yeah.
Which they sort of, as you said in your intro, you know, it's been used to stand in for other places in films, and now it is the Isle of Man, and they're like, look at us, we're in the Isle of Man constantly, standing in front of the town hall or the big sort of beam engine thing.
That's right, yeah, yeah. I mean, it goes to a few of the key tourist traps, you know.
And the fact he's very clearly insulted the entire island before jetting off to Hollywood to have his fantastic career, which obviously goes terribly wrong. The fact he's clearly insulted the island and therefore everyone on it is just beautifully used throughout, because he's not a popular man when he returns.
I mean, it's almost as if Julian Barrett were to show his face in Walthamstow.
He wouldn't dare.
I don't think they make enough of that, though. Playing two jokes at the same time there sometimes, because on one side it's like, I've insulted all of the Isle of Man, but equally, no one knows who I am because it was so long ago.
Yeah.
And so like the main subplot that I feel has been sort of airbrushed out is his son. Because he never says it in the film, but there's the young fresh-faced copper who I'm pretty sure is meant to be. So he has this whole subplot with Essie Davis where he thinks he has a daughter, whereas I believe under his nose he has a son. But I think that's been taken out because it probably brought an emotional angle that, you know, it's hinted a lot. Do you not get that? Okay.
I did not see that.
We particularly liked the joke when he's like, oh, and sorry about your mum.
Yeah, I think that's why in some ways, because it drives that joke too far, because he's not only sired this child, but the woman he sired it with is dead. But the age is right and the reason is there is right. So anyway, so I think that's one of the subplots that's been taken out.
That would be beautiful if Mindhorn's son became a real detective.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, to be inside your beautiful head.
When the film ends, Mindhorn, it ends on this beach scene, sequence and then go straight into the credits. And one thing it doesn't do, which would replicate the kind of show it was being in the first place, is a scene back at the station where they're all laughing and joking. And it feels like it ends really abruptly. I mean, I'm always happy when a film rocks in at 90 minutes and then goes into the credits, where we do hear but sadly don't see the video to You Can't Handcuff the Wind, which is the song he did, the David Soul-esque song, I guess, you'd say, as Mindhorn, and was a minor hit,
apparently. So
maybe bigger in Europe.
Okay, so lads, it's time to score. I like lads. Come on, guys. Come on, team. Team Sound Barrier. It's time to score. Which film do you feel scored highest on visual humour? For me, they are very close.
I think in the end, that sequence with him being glued into his... puts Mindhorn a little bit above.
Yeah, I would go with Mindhorn for that as well. But again, I did like much of Leaping Fish's contraptions and devices. But Mindhorn edges it for me.
I think with the obvious caveat that there is no way they could have made Mindhorn without the mystery of the Leaping Fish, and I bet you they saw it and nicked everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to go for Mindhorn. Well, I'm not bitter.
No, that's fine.
Old films, okay?
The moon was hot, the time was right, and you were looking so good. Our body heat was rising, I thought you understood. We had some fun together, but I never promised you forever.
It's not my style.
No, no, no. You can't handcuff the wind, and if you try, you're gonna fail. It's like trying to put thunder in jail. You can't handcuff the wind. I feel the pull of the open road. I'm heading out into the night. Gotta loosen up your grip, girl. You're holding on a little too tight. We rolled the dice, we played the game. Now every card's been turned. Girl, if you're trying to hold on to fire, you're gonna get burned.
You can't hang off the wind, and if you try,
in my feet.
Okay, so we're going to talk about more humour. We're going to talk about verbal humour. And I have to say that The Mystery of the Leaping Fish, I feel like its best verbal humour is almost on the screen, not in the intertitles.
This is where, obviously, I get to point out that it's a silent film, so verbal humour is always going to be tricky for Leaping Fish here. This is my job in every podcast that I have to point out that we are talking about a silent film when we talk about dialogue. But, of course...
Oh, my God, if you are knows that a Triangle Company 2 reel from 1916 would be silent, right?
But you're right, yeah. Obviously. Yeah.
I feel like the best verbal gags are things like the clock that says eat, sleep, dope, drink, rather than the intertitles, which are really kind of quite swift and sharp.
They are. They were too fast for me. And I actually went on to IMDb after I'd watched it and was looking, and fortunately found some other comments from people saying they flash up almost like you're on cocaine. If you're on cocaine, you might be able to read them because your brain would be working a bit faster. But not that it's a good thing, kids. But yeah, I
just have an espresso.
It was they were a bit too flashed up and flash off. But then I did like the fact that the large jar of the big hat box of powder was marked clearly cocaine.
Yeah. You don't want to make a mistake there.
Laudanum. Yeah. You know the clock which we mentioned earlier. Just those things were great.
It's a little Alice in Wonderland, isn't it?
Yeah. Whereas, you know, Mindhorn verbal humour is often about surprisingly silly accents. I mean, the best verbal humour is the Simon Farmer character by quite some way because of
the I've told a joke scene is just fantastic. Yeah. I know I made one over there and I've made one over here.
Whereas most of the other characters, it's all about the characters themselves. Mm. I mean, we don't get many gags. Mm. There are things which are, you know, as you mentioned, the sort of Thorncroft constantly asking for Americanos, which there are some good wordplay or some just knowing what words sound funny, which is why I go back to Wolfenstein not being funny. In that way, it's not a funny word, Wolfenstein.
You know, it was funny a few years ago, but these days it's just so damn expensive.
Exactly. It's just outpriced its own humour.
I feel like Mindhorn is a very wordy film. They talk an awful lot.
Yes, they do talk a lot, but it does seem to be in service of plot and characterisation rather than there's a gag here. I mean, there is the stuff about the dead mum. That comes back quite a bit and saying, sorry about your mum.
Clearly, you've focused so much more on the dead mum storyline.
I just felt like there was going to be a payoff there, that's all. Yeah.
You're watching out for clues.
Yeah, and you know, there's the daughter character.
You should be a detective.
I am a detective in many ways of excise subplots. yeah, there's the daughter character, or the not daughter character. The Isle of Man accent.
Yes.
Doesn't really get played out here, does it?
I'm not hugely familiar with the Isle of Man accent.
There's got to be one, right?
Yeah. I would think so. Yeah. But again, yeah, it's the only accent in the film is the stuntman.
Yeah. Oh, and Angela Reiser has an accent as well, but she just uses her own one. You haven't written me a character, really. I'm not going to get. I'm not going to have an accent as well.
I'm going to be Northern.
Yeah, I'm Northern.
Northern is default. I quite like that.
I mean, the Kestrel has a few good verbal gags. Just in his own talking about, and his fresh-facedness talking about what Mindhorn means to him and so on. So there is... And yeah, there is the telephone stuff where he is given a list of things that he shouldn't say down the phone and then says them instantly.
Yeah. I think that... One of the things that's quite interesting to compare it with a silent film, or possibly quite frustrating to compare it with a silent film, is that a lot of the humour in Mindhorn isn't necessarily verbal, but it is vocal. Mm. So, I mean, Julian Barrett's whole thing about having his actor voice, you can tell he moves into his Mindhorn voice, and he does all those vocal exercises. It's really quite ridiculous. And that's a gag in itself.
Yeah.
He is just talking utter nonsense most of the time. The audition is another example of vocal humour. And I wonder whether that maybe... They might slightly regret that sequence.
Yeah. So there's a moment at the beginning where he auditions for a Yardie role, let's say, because that's what it is, and doesn't realise, of course, that everyone who's up for the role is black, and does it in a patois.
But a very deep and resonant one. I mean, it's absolutely awful. You can tell how the line's meant to be delivered.
Yeah.
It's literally incredible, I believe, is how Kenneth Branagh himself describes it.
Yeah, it's literally incredible.
And that makes its way into the trailer. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done that. And yeah, if I was going to cut anything, I would cut that. I don't think, to be fair, actually, I don't think that sequence really adds much. Because you get all of that stuff from the Simon Callow stuff.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the scene with his agent is really funny and really sharp, and that really shows you that he's on his uppers without showing him fail in an audition as well. Yeah. In fact, maybe that's where the film could have been trimmed, maybe a little bit less at the beginning. Although I found the whole character just really quite delightful.
I mean, I think there is that, isn't there? There is that sense that, is this character best served by a motion picture? Or is it, you know, but then we already have... this kind of character in Toast of London. Mm. We've had Alan Partridge. I mean, we've had this kind of character. Yeah. And it's like the pompous act plot
for a
film.
Julian Barrett's played him several times in the Mighty Boosh.
Yeah. And this kind of plot as well, you know, is having an actor then playing a cop or going undercover. We've had The Hard Way with Michael J. Fox and James Wood. This kind of thing is not revolutionary. This is not like the first time we've seen this plot.
One thing I think we talked about when we saw it is it reminds us a little bit of Hot Fuzz.
Yeah.
Except Hot Fuzz is aping really glamorous, successful American blockbusters. So there's so much more going on plot-wise and pace-wise. And I really liked Mindhorn for taking something a little bit slower and smaller and a bit more tawdry as its basis and being inspired by something that's not quite so high octane. Because at the end, I did walk out going, do you know what? That was a good film and it was a good British film and it was a film about things that I, as a British person, grew up in the 80s, I grudgingly admit, can remember.
Well, I grew up reading Sherlock Holmes, so...
Oh, yeah, we read that too. Oh, we're back to Conan Doyle as well, aren't
we? Yeah, indeed, yes, our old friend. So, yes, the Kilkenny Diaries. I mean, I don't know what Conan Doyle's response to The Mystery of the Leaping Fish would have been. I haven't looked it up, unfortunately.
I'm not sure he would have been impressed.
I think he would have laughed like a drain.
I would find it interesting to pair that with the sort of William Gillette, very similar era, very serious Sherlock Holmes silent adaptation that there was. I think we're ready to score on a verbal humour, which yes. might have transformed into something slightly different.
Oh, I'm going to give it to Mindhorn because it's got more words in it.
It's always a pleasure to have you on board, Pete.
What I do.
Julian.
I can't quite believe I'm doing this, but I'm going to give it to the silent film.
Yay.
I'm going to give it to The Mystery of the Leaping Fish.
Me too, because I think that when I remember Leaping Fish, I remember it's where it's sort of, as you said, like outrageously using words shamelessly, like walking off with a case called Disguises. So I think that Leaping Fish makes words funny. Now, this is where you two talk amongst yourselves about softball or records or girls. Well, I do some sums.
Or you just edit it in. That's what I would do.
That's possible.
So, drum roll, guys. That's how Julian Barrett would do it. It's a controversial decision.
Uh-oh.
We may have to go to a last-minute round because we've got 9 points for Mindhorn and 9 points for The Leaping Fish. So, do we have a knockout blow?
Yeah, well, I think the tiebreak is which one did you laugh the loudest in? The one moment where you laughed the loudest. Now, this is probably not very fair for you, Julian, because you didn't see it in the cinema, The Leaping Fish. Well, we've seen both of them in the cinema.
Yes, we have.
In the end, it is the reveal of Mindhorn in his action figure outfit that I lost my shit to. I've got to say, for all my problems with other aspects of the films, that will burn in my brain. And to be fair, his capoeira as well near the end.
We didn't even talk about the capoeira, which I meant to align with Douglas Fairbanks' parkour, but he doesn't really use that in Leaping Fish. So.
Yeah, well, he does jump around a bit. But yeah. And his fight is, he does do a jumping fight, which basically just jumps people out the room.
Yeah, we could have done comic fighting.
Yeah.
What do you reckon, Julian?
I think the moment where the motorbike keys are thrown away probably made me laugh the loudest, and that's obviously Mindhorn.
Yeah.
Well, you guys have decided, I don't have to say.
Yeah.
Mindhorn wins by a whisper.
I mean, just to show, we care for both of these films a lot.
Yeah,
we do.
Thanks for listening to The Sound Barrier. Mindhorn is out now. I hope you enjoy it if you see it in the cinema. And The Mystery of the Leaping Fish can be streamed at archive.org or several places on YouTube. The Sound Barrier is presented in association with SOAS Radio, so thanks very much to them. And thanks to Julian for joining us this time.
My pleasure.
If you have any suggestions for films we could match up, then please do let us know in the comments on silentlondon.co.uk or tweet us at silentlondon.
A dog's purpose is still out there.
We are not going to find a dog's purpose on this podcast. You can find more episodes of the Silent London podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And the next episode of The Sound Barrier will be with you in a fortnight. We'll be announcing the films for that instalment soon. So if you'd like to watch what we're watching, keep an eye on the Silent London Facebook and Twitter channels. Goodbye.
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 Yeah, it was literally incredible.